I got your names?
Catherine Fagan.
Emery Dondino.
Charles Dondino.
And why did you guys come here tonight?
Well, they've been really interested in what the whole election process is about, seeing signs up around town, and so they wanted to understand what it all meant for the Indigenous community.
That's really cool. And how old are you?
I'm 12.
You just asked a question in there to, like, five politicians. What was your question?
What would you do about learning Indigenous culture and...
It was, what would you do about learning Indigenous history and culture in schools?
At this federal election forum in downtown St. John's, 12-year-old Emery Dandino had a very important question for Canada's political parties. Emery and her family made their way to the all-candidates forum, hosted by the group First Light, to hear the answer. And Unreserve's Amanda Gear caught up with them right after.
Just about understanding what it's all about, you know, the types of questions and how they answer. And they were like, are they Indigenous? Like, what does this mean? You know, what does it mean to go and represent us? So I think that's really what it's about, you know?
Definitely.
First Light is an advocacy group for urban Indigenous people living in St. John's. They want candidates to clearly state their positions on truth and reconciliation.
I think tonight I wanted to see any parties that are willing to show in a concrete way how they're going to go beyond just the talk about reconciliation, going beyond consultations, but really implementing UNDRIP and things like that. I think there's often a lot of talk to, around reconciliation, but I really see very little that it comes through. So,
are you going to get out and vote?
Definitely. I'll bring these guys with me, but they're a little bit too young.
Yeah. And what did you learn? Did you learn anything?
No, not really.
You're here for the snacks, aren't you?
Yeah.
Tanse Anin Bujou. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Canada's federal election campaign is well underway. Many voters are thinking about who is best to deal with our American neighbors. But Indigenous election activists and advocates want to remind political parties of issues closer to home.
We voted.
Kara Curry Hall still believes there is power at the polls. She led Rock the Indigenous Vote back in 2015, when at least 1 million new Indigenous voters cast their ballots. She says the resulting transfer of power from the Conservatives to the Liberals is proof that Indigenous voters can make a difference.
We shifted the nation and we took our place in the nation and within the governments.
And in St. John's, Newfoundland, urban Indigenous people gathered at an all-candidates forum to make sure reconciliation stays part of the conversation.
I haven't heard personally anything from any candidates around what their plan is to advance truth and reconciliation. So we're really pushing to have candidates in our area speak to those issues.
But what if you don't vote because you don't want to support a colonial system? Well, Andrea Landry believes there is power in that too.
I think what needs to take place is we need to disrupt the current trajectories and trend of co-opting the status quo projects and work towards innovative projects that affirm our self-determination by our own definition.
Today, Indigenous activists and advocates who empower and elevate Indigenous voice, if not the vote, in the federal election. For as long as she can recall, Andrea Landry's mother made sure that she knew that she was Anishinaabe. When Andrea was 13, she taught her another important lesson. During an event in her school gymnasium, the national anthem began. People on the crowded bleachers all stood up to sing "O Canada, Our Home and Native Land." But as Andrea prepared to stand, her mother pulled her back down. She told her, "We are not Canadian. We are Anishinaabe and shouldn't stand for a song that isn't theirs." It's for this same reason that you won't see Andrea at the polls for this or any other election. Andrea has never voted in Canadian federal or provincial elections, but she does plan on staying informed. Andrea, welcome to Unreserved.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And thanks for being here. Take me back to that moment in your school gymnasium as a nerdy 13-year-old, assuming you were a nerd like I am. Why does that moment stand out in your mind?
It stands out because I was living in Thunder Bay at the time, and I was going to a high school that, and I experienced quite a bit of racism already. And there were like a few other Indigenous students at the high school. And a lot of us were targeted for the color of our skin, for who we were, you know, a lot of the regular racial slurs, you know, and at the time were very common. And so in that moment, like my mom was very obviously brown, very obviously Anishinaabe. Like when we did that, when that experience happened for me, it was like putting myself under the microscope for everyone to see. And my first instinct was my nervous system went into overdrive and I was like, this is going to cause more bullying. But after reassurance in that moment, it went from this is going to cause more bullying to I'm so proud and I'm so glad my mom is my mom. When I reflect back on it now, now that my mom's gone, it really highlights, yeah, I'm proud that she was my mom and that she taught me these valuable principles in life for who I am and where I come from.
Yeah. Moments like that really shape a person, right? When you have that highlight reel of experiences, what about it stood out for you? How did you feel like when your mother told you you're not Canadian, you shouldn't be standing for this song?
It wasn't like the first time she's ever said anything like that at that age. It trickled in over the years in my growth and my development. We spent a lot of time back home on the res in the summers. I knew that we were Anishinaabe. She always ensured that we knew we were Anishinaabe and that we practiced our cultures and our way of life as best as she could with what she knew. So for me, it wasn't like surprising. And I also think it was the first time I had a grasp on the political sense of it all. Being 13, my brain was developing more and I was getting a stronger sense of history, of what happened to our peoples. And so for me, it was more of like the political sense and the political understanding of where she was coming from with how she was raising us.
And when, for you, did that 13-year-old grow into the wonderful, strong, amazing land defender, rights knowledge carrier person that you are today who doesn't vote? Was there a moment where you're like, okay, this is who I am. This is who I'm being told I should be participating in this system that I don't believe in. Was there a moment for you?
I think it was a vote, like voting age. Yeah, it was voting age. And there was a lot of pressure from my workplace, from peers, from the university. It was like the Indigenous vote is going to change things. The Indigenous vote is going to rock the house, right? And this is your chance to make change. And I remember really having to think about it. And I remember even thinking I should go vote. Like, yeah, it's going to make change. And there was like this inner battle. It was like, that's not who we are, though, as Indigenous peoples. And during that time in my life, like I never experienced change coming from Canadian politics for my community and my people. The only types of change I've seen were when families were making change in their own families, or when my community was doing things right for themselves outside of Canadian political systems. And so it was like that little internal battle. And then I made my decision. I was like, no, I don't need to vote. It's not going to benefit my people in the way that we need to benefit.
Could you unpack that a little bit? Because I'm hearing you say that was the moment when you decided you weren't going to participate in voting and in elections. And you say that you don't feel voting changes anything.
So I think that it could make small shifts. And the current system is very reactionary. And because it's reactionary, it also lacks the foresight that's reflective of who we are as the original peoples of these lands. We can't look for solutions within systems that are benefiting from the problems that are created by these systems. And so what I was witnessing even in my teen years were these political systems that were designed to keep us oppressed, right? People in my community, young people committing suicide, right? the lack of clean drinking water in so many communities. Watching my parents watch the news when I was, you know, in my early teens, and seeing the conditions of housing, of poverty, of all these things, and recognizing that it's these systems that set this up this way. And so it's like, for me at that age, it was like, these are all the problems that my people are living in. These are the crises, the multiple crises that are happening. And our people are trying to invest all of our time and energy to fix things while working with Canadian political systems. And the Canadian political system continues to maintain how things are for it. Look at today, compared to how I was a child, things haven't changed. Even in my older years, when I did my master's, I started doing a lot of research on, well, what kind of political conversations were taking place in the 1950s, 1960s. I looked through the archives on the white paper. I looked through the archives on the discussions with the red paper. I looked at, you know, the OCA crisis, and it was the same asks. Our people asking and begging for the same shifts and changes through Canadian political systems, and seeing no results. So for me at the time, it was like connecting the dots and recognizing these systems are robbing us of our precious time and energy. Yeah. And we're constantly trying to put out these little fires, and we have no time and energy to work on something bigger for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. If you are saying that we as Indigenous people, as First Nations, as the nations that were here before Canada was Canada, can't change a system from the inside, then what instead?
I think what needs to take place is we need to disrupt the current trajectories and trend of co-opting the status quo projects that are often the Band-Aid solutions to the issues at hand that we're seeing in our communities, and work towards innovative projects that affirm our self-determination by our own definition that is led and guided by our people. Mm-hmm. Rather than Canada saying, oh, here's some money and here's a project that's going to work for fixing the suicide epidemic in your community, because we have children as young as 8 and 9 killing themselves on our reserves. Mm. That money is not going to be the solution to that problem.
Yeah.
There's so much at hand occurring in our family systems due to the ongoing attempts of colonization, due to intergenerational trauma. It's not the Canadian political system that's going to stop a 9-year-old child from killing themselves on a reserve.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the reality. It's like funneling our energy into projects that surpass Band-Aid solutions outside of the current Canadian political system that is very reactionary in how they respond to our people.
How do we ensure that our, you know, that our voice is being heard in, you know, because we have this current political system, we have the parties, we have the electoral process that we have to go through. How then do we ensure that our voices are being heard in those decision-making processes? Do we stand with treaty? Do we stand with building our own systems aside, within, without? How does that look like for you?
Yeah, I'm not one to tell people what to do and how to, you should go vote or don't vote or do this or do that. You know, it's really up to how people want to live. And for me personally, it's like standing firm in what I know and what I know to be true. And standing firm in what am I personally investing my time and energy in for a better future for my children and for the young people that are in my life. Because how I relate to the world and how I stand firm in who I am and where I come from is going to trickle down to the coming generations. We look time and time again how many times we have begged, how many times our people have pleaded, have cried on the steps of parliament and in the offices of ministers, begging for solutions for the lives of our children. And there's nothing. And so for me, it's like, well, how do we ensure our voices are heard? We ensure our voices are heard within our own families and within our own communities.
Mm-hmm. And how does that, you know, standing up and being that sovereign person within a sovereign nation then lead to saving that 9-year-old from committing suicide?
It comes down to supporting ourselves and our families. Like one of the things that I've highlighted is doing our work our emotional work, our healing work, our grief work, and showing children around us in our communities that this is how we can heal. This is how our families can heal. And when we begin to heal, we can start working as a collective. And people will say, how is that political? How are you practicing your sovereignty and nationhood when you're just healing? And it's like, that's the most political act I can do, because in that, it's going to lead to building community together, to building a common ground. What do we need? What do our children need in our communities so that they can survive and thrive? And how can we work together? Because we know Canada isn't going to solve our problems. Look at our schools. Yeah, look at it. Look at our roads. I often ask a general question to any Canadian, anyone who identifies as Canadian, any settler: have you ever been to a reserve? You know, go spend a weekend on a reserve, not during the powwow when everyone's happy and having the time of their lives. Go in the middle of the dead of winter when families are struggling and suffering. Go help out. Go cook soup for the hall when there's a wake or funeral, and you'll see what condition our people are in socially because of the ongoing attempts of colonization. And so for me, it's like, what's going to disrupt that? These innovative strategies outside of the colonial systems that have created these situations for us, that focus on healing, that focus on how can our families thrive? How can our communities thrive together?
And yet, as you know, as a scholar, as somebody who is very up on what is happening in community and in the country, in politics generally, you still stay informed. Why do you want to stay informed about a system that you're not taking part in?
I think for me, it's just to be like on the lookout of what could possibly happen. How do we prepare as a family? You know, heightened food prices is going to affect us. So it's like, well, what can I do? You know, I'm not going to depend on Canada to lower food prices for my family. I'm going to think, well, we should be maybe expanding our garden this summer. Yep. And continuing to snare rabbits like I do with my daughter. Yeah. And continuing land-based practices. It's like the consequences of whoever gets in. Yeah, it will impact my communities, our communities. And so how am I going to respond to that with innovative approaches outside of the system? Yeah. And it's like, there's lots we can do. Yeah. It doesn't have to be like a huge wellness center in the middle of a reserve, although that would be amazing, right? It could be something as simple as, let's teach our kids how to grow their own food. Let's teach myself how to hunt a moose in the fall time and stock our freezers up so that we can sustain ourselves. Let's teach each other what originally worked for our people based on our original morals, values, and principles as the original peoples of these lands. And what that would look like today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Snaring a rabbit was one of the first things my mom taught me.
Sweet.
Just as an aside.
Yeah, my daughter loves it. Yeah, it's awesome.
And you know, given everything that you've said and where you stand in terms of voting, in terms of your identity as a sovereign Anishinaabekwe, what kind of future do you envision for your daughters and for theirs?
Like based on where things are at politically and in this sense of like social systems, things either in this generation or the coming generation, it's going to lead to a collapse, a systemic collapse of some kind, right? And so a lot of the old people have talked about hard times for a long time. You got to prepare for hard times. You got to get your kids ready. You have to make sure you're stocking up on the necessities. Teach your children how to hunt. Teach your children how to live on the land. And so for me, it's like, if that time is coming based on what the old people are saying, yeah, I'm going to prepare my kids. Yeah. And also prepare them on how to do the research necessary for their own political mind. Yeah, to always read, always keep updated, always know what's going on socially and politically so that we are prepared and we're not going to respond in reactionary ways. But it's like just being mindful of that and being aware of the future and preparing versus reactionary responses.
Andrea, thank you so much for your time today and your thoughts.
Perfect. Miigwech for having me. It was awesome.
Andrea Landry is an Anishinaabe mother and teaches in the Indigenous Social Work Program at the First Nations University of Canada. She is originally from Pays Plat First Nation in Northern Ontario and resides on Treaty 6 territory on Poundmaker Cree Nation in Saskatchewan. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Still ahead.
You know, my dad used to say this, and the press picked up on it, and it was that Native people are like a sleeping giant. And it is true. We are a giant nonetheless, and we're no longer asleep.
In the 2015 federal election, Kara Curry Hall woke that sleeping giant with the Rock the Indigenous Vote. Indigenous voters showed up to the polls in record-breaking numbers. Many attribute the spark was comments by then-Prime Minister Stephen Harper about missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. His conservative government was not in support of a national inquiry, and Kara says that mobilized a red wave to rise and vote him out.
We shifted the nation, and we took our place in the nation and within the governments. We responded forcefully to the provocation and the voice that said we were not a priority. And we proved that indeed we are a priority, and don't ever mess with us again.
We'll hear more from the founder of Indigenous Rock the Vote a little later in the show. But first, Logan Stotts is an award-winning musician with a sound inspired by the rich blues and rock legacy of his community of Six Nations. The Mohawk artist has toured his music widely since his debut album back in 2015. But music isn't the only thing that gets Logan out on the road. He regularly joins the front lines of water and land defenders, from Standing Rock to Wet'suwet'en.
I'm in support of direct action, you know? I think that's where we are right now, is direct action, you know, and that can mean so many things. That can mean being at the blockade, you know, that could mean practicing our sovereignty in other ways, you know, through food or community gardens or revitalization of our languages, you know. And I think just going back and taking a look at, you know, our traditional beliefs and keeping those alive, and keeping those old good ways alive is the most important to me right now. Being on the front lines, you know, being at Wet'suwet'en, being at Fairy Creek, being at Land Back Lane, being at Camp Morgan. You know, one thing that I've realized is that as a musician, I have a platform, you know, and that platform can be used in a way to amplify and spread an awareness, you know, about these issues. You know, and to me, over the years, I've realized that maybe that's a more useful tactic personally than, you know, going toe to toe with the state and getting arrested. And, you know, I just feel like music is such a powerful part of the voice of the people. So if I can just keep embodying the spirit of my community and my music, you know, the best way that I can, I feel like that is one of the most useful things that I can do. You know, I think right now we're in a time where I think it's important for everyone to have, you know, their medicine on them. The sage, the cedar, the sweetgrass, the tobacco, you know. And I don't know that I have a medicine bag big enough to carry everything that I need right now. But throughout all of it, you know, I'm just going to keep doing what I know that I can do. And that's play music.
Best I ever was, the best I ever. best there ever will be.
That's Logan Stotz featuring Aspect with Love, Sweet Love. You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, U.S. Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, as Canadians head to the polls, we hear the voices of activists and advocates who are sparking power in this political moment.
I'm out here as a member of the urban Indigenous community. We are interested in hearing what the candidates have to say, and just trying to make an informed decision in the election over who is concerned about our issues and who maybe isn't quite as concerned as we think they should be.
Mark Humber is about to take his seat at a community-run forum in downtown St. John's. Candidates from all five political parties showed up in hopes of persuading voters. Indigenous attendees hope to find out their ongoing efforts around reconciliation. Unreserved's Amanda Gear spoke with a few of the community members with questions for the candidates.
You know, the political landscape has been a bit scary, let's say, in the last few months, especially due to what's been going on with our neighbors to the south.
Yeah.
The three T's, right? Tariffs, taxes, and Trump. Is that informing you in any way on which way you're going to vote or what you're looking for from a candidate?
I mean, obviously our international partnerships are always important, and it's important that Canada's allied with countries that align with our interests more broadly. But specifically in this election, I'm definitely more focused on local issues than international issues. Like, I am interested in the national landscape, but today I'm here to listen to the candidates of St. John's East, and I want to hear what they have to say, how their ideas are going to impact the local community.
It's around legislation that needs to be done. It's around real awareness of the rights and freedoms and the collaboration that needs to be done. It can't be done in isolation in any way, shape, or form. So there's really quite a
few. What's your name?
Cassidy Lush.
And is this your first time voting?
Yes, it will be.
What are you looking for in a candidate, Cassidy?
Somebody who's going to support Indigenous people in our communities, people who are going to support women's rights and LGBTQ+ rights and the rights of just people in general. I haven't really been keeping up with any of the parties except for the main ones that I like listen to, so it'll be good to hear from the ones that I don't really keep up with.
Yes, so the Communist Party of Canada fully supports every aspect of UNDRIP. It is very important that those get cemented in our country and in our law.
What are you doing here tonight?
I was searching for a chance to see some of the candidates, answer questions, and hear them in person. I thought it would be a good chance to hear them talk about issues that I don't normally associate with, so expand my horizons a little bit, but just see how they do. I think underserved communities should be at the forefront of politics and community, and hearing candidates talk about those issues gives me an idea of how they're going to treat the general populace. And I think there's a lot of different policy proposals around Indigenous issues, and I wanted to be in a setting here today to hear them talk about it, but also be surrounded by people who those issues were close to.
Nothing can happen without full Indigenous partners.
That's Nick House, and before that, Cassidy Lush and Mark Humber, speaking with Unreserved Associate Producer Amanda Gear. The All Candidates Forum was hosted by First Light, a nonprofit community organization in St. John's. A few years ago, it created an advocacy group called First Voice to lead the charge on policy shifts and other systemic changes within government. Chad Bedard is the manager of knowledge mobilization for First Voice. I spoke with him ahead of last week's forum. Chad says public events like this give space to ask questions and candidates the opportunity to answer them.
So we're actually hosting an event to try and educate the urban Indigenous community, but also enticing the candidates to speak about their platform or when it comes to reconciliation and what issues they see as pressing, because unfortunately because of what is happening to our South, everything seems to be overshadowed, especially if reconciliation seems to be overshadowed by tariffs and what's the plan with Trump and, you know, those sorts of things. And it's really, I haven't heard personally anything from any candidates around what their plan is to advance truth and reconciliation. And we know that it is kind of stalled at this time. So we're really pushing to have the candidates in our area speak to those issues. And it's, you know, we are a nonpartisan organization. However, we want to provide them the opportunity to speak to these issues.
While First Voice hasn't organized around a federal election before, Chad says they're fueled by some successful campaigns in the most recent provincial and municipal elections. One success was the campaign to create a civilian oversight committee in the province that would investigate cases involving RCMP. Municipally, their campaign to rename a long-standing holiday was also a success.
At the municipal level, the City of St. John's actually recognized National Indigenous Peoples Day last year for the first time. It did start out as Discovery Day, which we know is problematic in its name immediately. So they did change it from Discovery Day to the June holiday, but then last year they actually made the change to National Indigenous Peoples Day. Unfortunately, it cannot be held on National Indigenous Peoples Day every year because that is a provincial statutory holiday, which has to be changed at the provincial level. So we're hoping that, you know, the city of Mount Pearl, which is the city right next to St. John's and just as large, a little bit smaller, but that we hope that the dominoes start to fall and the other cities and municipalities start to get on board with what we're trying to do, which will perhaps force the hand of the provincial government to try and join on in our reconciliation efforts.
Mm, these are some really, you know, tangible actions and results that you've been able to see with this group. What does that tell you about the power of the, you know, Indigenous vote or Indigenous participation in elections?
It says a lot to the way in which we're able to advocate. And we know that there are times when Indigenous people don't feel represented, and that's why we're trying to educate and get them, have the candidates speak on these issues. Because right now, like I said, I haven't heard anything about Indigenous issues or reconciliation come across any platform whatsoever. So we're trying to hold them accountable and say, well, what is your platform when it comes to reconciliation? What is your plan? Where are you going to go with this? And that allows the Indigenous community to have a voice and say, okay, I actually hear what they're going to do for me. Whereas in the past, or if we don't do this, you know, it's very easy to say, well, they don't care anyways, right? And to go on mm-hmm. without voting. But we're also trying to reduce some of the barriers that come up when it comes to voting. And, you know, even voting can be a daunting task. It can be something that is difficult and you don't understand. And we're trying to reduce those barriers as best we can with education and, you know, with some seminars and sessions and stuff to help educate our community. And, you know, there's also things like having proper ID, having a fixed address. And we're hoping that with the support of Elections Canada, we can actually reduce those barriers.
Yeah. You know, reconciliation it played a large role in the last election. There was lots of talk about reconciliation and how we were going to proceed with that. Why do you think that it's, you know, fallen off the radar and it doesn't seem to be a subject for discussion in this election?
I don't know if it's being, I think it's being overshadowed right now by especially the trade war with the United States is a really easy topic to bring up and to pull on different levels of Canadians' heartstrings when it comes to their money. So I don't know if it's as important right now for the politicians, but that's the issues that we're trying to alleviate and trying to figure out. Where is their platform? What is their stance? We know where you stand when it comes to tariffs. We understand that you want to do X, Y, and Z when it comes to Trump, but we want to know what you're going to do about advancing reconciliation. And we know, you know, that certain candidates in the past have had a really large platform when it comes to Indigenous issues.
Can you give me an example of, you know, some of the issues within reconciliation and truth and reconciliation and the calls to action that you're asking candidates to be educated on?
One of the things that we've been looking at is one of our top call for change is around education. And for this is more of a provincial level, but with support from the federal government, we can get things done. And it's around, you know, changing the K-12 curriculum in this province, because we know that there are inaccuracies throughout the K-12 curriculum in this province. And we need to provide the proper education so that the next generation of youth coming up aren't given the same misinformation that, you know, a lot of other people across Canada have been given. And that education will provide another, the next level of support that we really need to advance truth and reconciliation.
How did you decide that, you know, education was going to be a priority for you?
I think that one of the main things is that without education, we're going to continue repeating ourselves and we're going to be spinning our wheels. So if we aren't educating the general public or the greater community around both Indigenous issues and inaccuracies that they've been taught in the past, we aren't going to garner the support when it comes to changing policies. And we'll get a whole lot of pushback when we ask to have different things change. If we don't have that level of education where everybody actually understands, oh, that was really not right. Okay, so I was taught the wrong way. I'm so sorry. And once we have that level of education, once everybody, you know, I guess for lack of a better word, understands the truth. You always have to have the truth before you can have the reconciliation. And that level of truth in our province, unfortunately, is not where it should be. So that is one of the main reasons that was chosen as a high priority.
Right. What advice would you have, you know, for Indigenous people across Canada, you know, during this very important election? Like, every election is important, but this one seems particularly important to participate in. What advice would you have, you know, for Indigenous people who want to make sure that these issues that matter to them are getting through to politicians, first of all, and that they are participating in an election, however that may look?
I would say that the number one thing is to educate yourself as much as you possibly can. Do your own research. Find out what they've voted for and against in the House of Commons already. See where they stand on these issues in the last 2 years. If it's something that they're continuously voting against when it comes up, you know, that's not obviously ideal. And ask questions, right? If you're able to, you know, write a letter or get it out in the news, whatever you can to try and I'd say stir the pot a little bit and get these politicians thinking a little bit more about reconciliation than they have been, because the Indigenous population is massive in Canada, and we do hold a great vote. So we need to start asking the questions of what are you going to do? What's in it for us, right? You know, we understand where you stand in a lot of other issues, but we haven't heard a lot about reconciliation. And what are you going to do to try and advance that at a national level? And, you know, how are you going to keep advancing the opportunities for nation to nation building, right? How are you going to recognize the Indigenous nations across this state? And how are you going to continue advancing that? And just ensure that we're not taking a step backwards is really what we want to do.
Mm. Well, Chad, thank you so much for your time today and your insights.
Yeah, no problem. I appreciate you having me on. Thank you very much.
Chad Bedard is Manager of Knowledge Mobilization for First Voice. Chad is Haida from Haida Gwaii, BC, and lives in St. John's. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, US Public Radio, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, finding power at the polls and within our own communities. It's been almost 10 years since Justin Trudeau rode a red wave into leadership for the first time. Kara Curry-Hall says that historic victory showed the power of Indigenous voters. Kara co-founded the Rock the Indigenous Vote movement in the United States, where she now lives. She organized her community to vote as a bloc and elect leaders who would give them a seat at the table. In 2015, she saw an opportunity to bring the movement to Canada, where she was born and raised. Today, she's still rocking the vote on both sides of the colonial border and says that in this election, Indigenous voters can once again make history. Kara, welcome to Unreserved.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much for having me back. And I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad that you're here. And we spoke last in 2015. Take me back to that year. Why did you start Rock the Indigenous Vote in Canada?
Well, previous to 2015, I was involved in several campaigns, and one of the more recent ones to that one was a presidential campaign in the United States. America was going to see and elect its first ever Black person to become a president. And this person was of somebody of color, somebody who could relate to us as being oppressed and unrepresented. And we matter-of-factly took advantage of that opportunity. We, which is a lot of Indigenous people that were activists or advocates or strategists, we all just joined hands and said, let's go and let's do a push in Indian country. And then it really mattered. We were able to be heard. And of course, that president was President Obama.
And so when did you look, you know, over here on this side of the border and say, oh, I think I want to do that, you know, now that you had this influence in your medicine bundle? Why did you want to bring it over here?
Well, I've stayed involved in Canada. I go back and forth. Obviously, my family's from there. I'm from there. When the Idle No More movement started, I heard a comment that was really provocative. And the comment came from the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper. And he refused and rejected the notion to do an inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women. That's me and you. That's us. And his commentary was, it's not a priority. Meanwhile, our sisters are being murdered in cold cases, and no one's raising their voice. But Idle No More did. They started their movement. So we carried on, joined hands with Idle No More, and said, let's mobilize the voters, because of what we're able to see in the United States and the impact that we're able to have. And one of the parties back then asked me a question and said, well, what's the difference with you guys and everybody else? It wasn't taken as serious, which is fine. They really don't take Native people serious, because historically we don't really vote in elections. But I responded and I said, what's the difference between us and everybody else is swingability. And I'm still right.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, this is the spark, right? That what Prime Minister Stephen Harper then had said about the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women was not a priority. If that was the spark, then how did you fan it to make it this huge flame that really roared across the country?
Well, I determined and talked with my husband, and I said, I'm going to go to Canada. And I thought initially that I was just going to go to Calgary and campaign against Stephen Harper. But there was a bigger plan in play. And, you know, having the background of working with the Assembly of First Nations, I had a good handle on what the lay of the land was. Who are the chiefs? Where are the chiefs? And they knew me. And so they could talk to me and I could talk to them. The expectation later became that they were expecting me to brief them on what was going on in the election. So we had the ability to reach nationally, and we did. We established this small group. I had a conference call with leaders, and I said, here's what I'm going to do, and I'm going to need your help. And it took a meeting to convince them this is the right thing to do at the right time, and it's going to take all of us. And then all five of the national organizations came on side and endorsed the initiative, the Rock the Indigenous Vote.
And so how did you then engage community to participate in Rock the Vote?
Well, it was a lot of the chiefs. And if you recall back then, one of the grand chiefs in Manitoba, and it was actually Sheila North at the time, started a contest amongst each other that the chiefs, I could turn out more votes than you can. And so they started rallying their own people, their own bands, and getting them registered. And then I started a merchandise movement. I produced a T-shirt, thanks to my husband, with our logo on it, the Rock the Indigenous Vote. You know, people always want to be part of something that's really positive. And so all of a sudden, these shirts are being worn nationwide. Candidates are wearing them. You know, my mom and elders that were, my mom has gone on now, but there was elders that were going to be voting for the first time in their lives that wanted to wear those shirts. And way back then, my mom was doing little video clips for us. And so we used technology. We created platforms on social media to be seen, to be heard, and to inform, and then just to really engage our people. And it was powerfully effective.
Yes, indeed. My mom had one of those shirts. Adorable, gotta say.
Yeah.
What was the result of your, you know, Rock the Indigenous Vote movement here in Canada?
Well, you know, my dad used to say this, and the press picked up on it, and it was that Native people are like a sleeping giant. And it is true. We are a giant nonetheless, and we're no longer asleep. So what we did was we voted. We shifted the nation, and we took our place in the nation and within the governments. We responded forcefully to the provocation and the voice that said we were not a priority.
And we proved that indeed we are a priority, and don't ever mess with us again because we vote and it matters. And when we vote, it really matters.
Some would argue that, you know, while the Indigenous vote did help elect Justin Trudeau, some of his election promises did not come through, or they were broken. You know, like when his government approved the Trans Mountain Pipeline project after Saving Canada would no longer fund pipelines. What do you say to those who believe that none of the current political parties will uphold their interests? And we've in fact have seen that. No talk of reconciliation. Very little attention being paid to Indigenous, you know, bread and butter issues. What do you say to those people who are like, "What? It doesn't even matter."
I would say it does matter, and it's very, very important. And I understand that. I understand where they're coming from, because I was raised that way. I was raised and always told from my father, who was a chief, and my grandfathers were chiefs, that if you vote, you're going to lose your treaty right. Well, we've learned that that's actually not true. And I understand why they're saying it, because there was the fear of these governments advancing their assimilationist policies and oppressive legislation. And they were trying to defend us against that. Now, we've become more crafted in our participation in the nation. We are more strategic and analytical. And not to negate what they've done, because I know they sacrificed, of course. My father was a treaty chief. He was one of the chiefs that delivered the red paper to kill the white paper. He was on the Hill in full regalia, you know, with Harold Cardinal and Chief Norman Yellowbird. So this is where I'm coming from, too. And this is our responsibility to stay engaged. Keep the feet to fire of all of these leaders that are elected. We have a unique position as Treaty Indians in Canada that we reserve that. We are treaty nations, and then we're also given the opportunity to be Canadian citizens. And in that context, we can change government and we change nations. We can shake things up, and we do, because we're proving it that we have.
Yeah. And how is the campaign going to, you know, engage and talk people into participating, I guess? How is that Rock the Vote campaign going this time around?
Well, I've seen, and I'm not running this for them, but I've seen that the Assembly of First Nations has put out a platform document, and they've hired somebody, and they're putting out reports of what is the pulse, you know, who's the what and where, who's running where, and how could the Native vote help there. So the national organizations are pushing out the information to vote and participate, so they're advocating participation. The chiefs and leaders that I've been speaking with, they're doing the same thing. They're sending representation to different meetings, to talking to parties, informing the parties and the candidates of their positions.
And what are you hearing from those Indigenous leaders that they're hearing from Indigenous people about what's important to them?
Well, I'm talking, like I said, to different leaders, and there's some really important things, and it's always going to be our rights. And upholding our rights and recognizing our rights, our treaties. They're using some language, and it's coming out of the national organizations, and it's good language, but it needs to be expanded on. It's about reconciliation. And I'm not opposed to reconciliation, but I think we need to demand and inform what reconciliation really looks like, because we know that they have failed to implement any of the calls to action. Well, no, I take that back. They've implemented a couple, but it's a long list of 94. We need to start as the discussion with them as nations, that we want nation-to-nation relationships, and we'll stop talking about it and start doing it and stop finding excuses not to deal with us as nations. What I am hearing is that these one party in particular wants to deal with us on energy and economic development initiatives, but allow us to access capital through corporations. I said, oh, so you're like trying to reduce us to a client instead of dealing with us as a nation to nation. How about we sit at the table and we craft the deal, say, with America, and we be the decision makers. We be involved at the very outset as the owners of the minerals of the land. Because in the energy industry, what you do know is this: the most powerful people in the room are the owners. In elections, the most powerful people are the voters. So this is the now. This is the time that you ask to be at the table. And one of the other issues that I'm hearing is all of the, some people call them bread and butter issues. I said they're all very important. Not one's more important than the other. You have the water. Do we have clean, drinkable water? And if we don't, why not? Get on it. We also need housing, education, healthcare. We need those issues to be
up in the forefront alongside with the Child and Family Services. The Child and Family Services is ongoing and needs immediate resolution. It's a court order. Canada was guilty of discrimination. The funds have been allocated. Now Canada needs to stop finding obstacles and creating stumbling blocks and move along with the chiefs and start disseminating those funds back to the reservation so that the children's needs are being met. So those are some of the top ones that we're hearing.
A lot of those issues are really long-standing: housing, clean drinking water, child and family services overhaul. And we've been talking about these issues as Indigenous people for, well, probably since colonization arrived on our shores. How do we, you know, hold these leaders to the fire, you know, the feet to the fire after the election when they make the promises but then don't follow through? Then how do we make it happen?
Well, we have a short time window right now. We need to demand it in writing. There's, I think, that report from the Assembly of First Nations identified over 30 candidates running where the Indigenous vote canon would be the factor. If they get a high voter turnout, it will be the winning factor. And so if we know that much information, then let's vote. But you make the demands now, and the negotiation is now. And all the other groups, whomever they are, they're doing the very same thing. And we need to wise up and be really bold and assertive, not aggressive, not fighting. Very intentional. We know the value of our vote. We know the value of our resources. And if these guys want to run the government, then they need to listen to us. And we need to make ourselves heard. And they need to do things like this, you know, be on national media, get into the press, be heard and be seen.
Yeah. Kara, you spoke a little bit about your own family involvement in politics. Why is this work so important to you? Why is this such a passion for you, you know, after nearly two decades of Rock the Indigenous Vote?
I think when you find out what's natural to you, do that. And it's this, you know, it's having a sense of what is the discussion going on in this country and what's happening to our people. And I think most important is to give our people an opportunity to have a voice, because we've been suppressed for too long, for generations. And so when we realize that we have a voice, that we gain confidence and we gain boldness, and then we realize in asserting that voice and exercising a vote at the ballot, we really matter. We're powerful. It inspires our nations to rise up and be nations. It inspires our young people to look forward to a positive future. We are going to fight the fight. My father was an Indian residential school survivor. My mother was. My grandparents were. And you know, they darn well survived. And we owe them the best efforts. Do the best you can every day. And the best we can is scary to the non-Indian world, because we shift the nation. We change governments. It's unlimited to what we can do. It's really, my passion is driven to make it better. Make it better, make it a lot better, and change the circumstances and kill the oppressive legislation that we've been under for too many years.
Well, thank you so much for your time today and some of your insights. It's been a pleasure speaking with you again.
Likewise. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Kara Curry Hall is a co-founder of the Rock the Indigenous Vote movement. She is Cree from Montana First Nation in Alberta. That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Casher, Amanda Gear, Rhiannon Johnson, Elena Hudgens-Lyle, Caitlin King, and Donna Merrow. I'm your favorite cousin, Rosanna Deerchild, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Ginaskin the Mitnawau. Agusay.